Roger Angel says that he's usually described as a baseball essayist, a baseball historian, or a baseball poet, but he declines the honors. He thinks of himself as writing autobiography, the story of himself as a fan. He's written that continuing story since 1962, describing the baseball games and players and seasons he's watched, always trying to get at why it fascinates him. Angel's baseball essays are published in the New Yorker magazine, where he also works as the senior fiction editor. Every few years, Angel's baseball articles are collected in book form. His new book is titled Season Ticket. This week's edition of The New Yorker features Angel's annual piece on spring training. He once wrote that springtime is almost his favorite part of the baseball year. I asked him why.
The whole game is a little more accessible. Baseball is so difficult, really, for fans. The season itself has a lot of tension to it, and the players are harder to talk to because they're caught up in competition. And in spring training, particularly in Arizona, for some reason, the players seem a lot closer. The fact that the games don't count relieves us from the burden of importance that real fans put on every game. It's informal. It's the official end of winter. Baseball is, you know, is one of the greatest. Spring training is one of the greatest public relations devices that anybody ever thought up. It's wonderful, and you watch a little baseball, you watch some fly balls, and you think of your friends back home in the slush and the snow, and you feel superior.
Now, you've also written that your secret fear is that you'll find nothing fresh at spring training to write about, but that baseball always saves you. Well, what saved you from that this year?
Well, I talked to a lot of. I had no particular theme this year. I talked to some players that. I want to talk to him for various reasons. I talked to Bob Boone because he's now played more games at catcher than the hardest position of all than anybody in baseball history. I talked to Tony Gwynn, a wonderful young hitter. I talked to Dewey Evans because at the age of 36 of the Red Sox, he had the best season ever. And in the end, it sort of did come together as a theme because these are men are super professionals. And once again, I realized how much more competitive, how much stronger their wills are than the rest of us who weren't tested every day the way professional athletes are, and particularly the way baseball players are.
Pete, do you still wake up worrying, will there be anything new and exciting that I really want to write about this year?
Well, I don't anymore, Terry, because my cure for this, somewhere in my book, I've written that expertise is the cure for partisanship. I'm still trying to learn baseball. I've been writing about it for 25 years, and there's a lot I don't know. There's a lot I pick up almost every time I go to a game.
Well, one of the things you really love to do is to get pitchers to demonstrate pitches to you and catchers to show you how they stand and, you know, infielders to show you how they catch and throw.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in this book. I've sort of gone around from position to position and tried to learn how this game is really played. There's a whole, I think, a fascinating chapter on catching because Of all the skills, catching is the one that's most overlooked, perhaps because the catchers face away from us or something, or perhaps because we've sort of always patronized them a little bit, because when we were kids, they were the fat kids who, when we played ball, they were the fat kids who couldn't do anything else. But there's a lot to catching, an enormous amount if you think about it. The catcher is usually the smartest guy on the team, and he runs the game, and particularly he runs the pitchers, and he has to get top performance out of a group of different pitchers day after day, many of whom are not pitching at their best. It's a fascinating job. And, of course, he has to deal with umpires. And the relationship between catchers and umpires is extremely subtle. And there's a lot going on back there. And there are exchanges and conversations you don't see because the catcher can't turn around and talk to the umpire. But I learned a lot.
There's a slightly revised strike zone this year and a new balk rule. Are you a traditionalist, or do you like to see things change like that?
Well, the balk rule, to try to deal with that first, this has nothing to do with tradition. The umpires over the years, for just as a fad, I think, had, for some reason, had more and more given up the top levels of the strike zone. They just weren't calling anything above the waist, although it officially went up as high as the armpits. And they were calling lower and lower strikes, I'm talking about the strike zone actually, not the balk rule. And I think that the leagues decided to. It's strange enough they have slightly narrowed the strike zone. They brought the top level of it down, and then instructed the umpires to call that. So they're going to be calling more higher strikes, and we'll see what happens. I think that it's probably. And I think there'll be fewer home runs because the pitchers have a slightly larger strike zone to work to. The balk rule, they're trying to, the league's decided to try to stop a form of bending of the rules, if not cheating, where the pitches would not come to a complete halt with a base runner on first. And there's been a lot of complaining because the pitchers have to give up their traditional motion, whatever it is that they've learned to do, and come to a full stop with both feet on the ground. There's been a terrific fuss about this, but I think it's a spring fuss, and I think it'll die down in another month or so, and the umpires will give a little bit, and then we'll go on to the next thing in the season.
You've been writing about baseball since 1962. Are there any really major ways that you think you've seen the sport change?
I think the biggest change has been the increase in AstroTurf, the artificial turf, which really has changed the game. You have to have much faster infielders, quicker, better athletes out there because the ball flies by you so fast. And we've lost a few kinds of infield plays as a result, which is too bad. And you see there are still some those AstroTurf bounced hits. The ball is chopped on the ground and bounces over the infielder's head, which is sort of a perversion of the game. And the other complaint about, I guess the main complaint about, or to me the two main complaints are that it's very hard on the athletes' legs. There's a lot of wear and tear on AstroTurf. It's really like running on cement, slightly cushioned cement. And you've lost natural grass, which to me is one of the pleasures of baseball. You go and there should be a beautiful lawn out there, and the feeling that you're in the country, even if you're not, you know, it's a special part of the game.
You know, in 1982, you wrote that Big League Baseball is long past its innocent youth and well into what appears to be a disordered and self-destructive sort of middle age. Do you think that's still true?
I think things are somewhat better ordered than they were. I wrote that during the time of expansion, I think, and the beginning of the great labor troubles that went on for so long. But a lot of issues have been put aside by the Players Association and the owners, and the basic agreement comes up for renegotiation. The new contract has to be drawn a year from this coming winter, and there are a lot of issues that may cause immense difficulties, and I just hope it's not going to come to another strike. I hope the owners have learned that the players are grown-ups, and that if they feel they need to strike, they will do so. Before the great strike in 81, I kept hearing the owners saying, oh, you know, these kids, they'll never go out on strike. They won't go out on strike. I know them. And, of course, they did go out on strike. So I'm troubled about what's going to happen. And there's some major issues that have to be resolved about expansion and so forth. But I think the game is in better condition than it was a few years ago.
You know, that quote that I just read was also quoted in a newspaper editorial earlier this month. And the subject of the editorial was in part the way that the stadiums have degraded and the way that fans' behavior in the stadiums has degraded. And in the editorial, the writers wrote that they suggested that the parks are often dirty, the fans are rude and are sometimes dangerous, and that alcohol is usually the culprit. And the editorial calls for, you know, trying to cut down on the amount of alcohol and commends stadiums that have cut back on alcohol sales, that have limited alcohol sales. What do you think of that?
I absolutely agree. I think that it's not a great sacrifice to cut down on beer sales. I think if the more this goes on, the more we'll find families staying at home, families with young children. It's a real threat to the game because if you're going to get audiences that are violent, it's inappropriate to baseball in the first place. A lot of this comes out of the enormous expectations, the enormous emphasis on winning that is imposed by a lot of owners, a number of owners, people like George Steinbrenner, and by the television networks too. Winning seems to be everything, and winning is although everyone wants to win and every team wants to win, every player wants to win, strangely enough, it can't be at the top of the list in baseball because it's such an unforgiving game, such a difficult game. You can't dominate it. George Steinbrenner keeps trying to muscle his way to victory and to chastise his troops to go on winning. And it doesn't work that way. I mean, after all, the most successful ball players are only successful about a third of the time. You strike out or pop up or whatever. Two-thirds of the time, if you get a base hit, one-third of the time, you're a hero. It doesn't work that way. And people become impatient, I think, in big crowded stadiums if this is the message they're getting from the owners. There are teams and owners around who have gone the other way, who have saying go to the game. The pleasure of being at the park is the number one thing. Bill Veeck always said that baseball is meant to be savored, and he had a deep understanding of that. There are some fans who were, you know, as intense as any, and sometimes very loud and vehement the Cubs fans I'm thinking of, who seem to understand this and take the game with a little more patience.
Roger Angel is my guest. He writes about baseball for the New Yorker magazine, and a new collection of his pieces has just been published. It's titled Season Ticket. When you go see a game, are you usually in the press box, or are you mingling with the fans?
Well, I do both. I go in the press box and because it's comfortable and I get a good seat. But I try as often as possible to go with a friend or with my family and sit in the stands too, because the presence of fans is a crucial part of this. And I am a fan. I'm allowed to write as a fan. I write for the New Yorker and in these pieces that make books now, this new book, Season Ticket. There's a lot of references to we, meaning we fans. And I can talk about myself as a fan, and readers of mine know which teams I care most about.
So what's the difference between writing as a fan and writing as a sports writer for a newspaper?
Well, I think objectivity is fine. I guess you have to have it if you're a newspaper writer, but I think that the beat men, the people who cover all the teams, are fans. All the ones I know are fans, although they try to keep it quiet. But if in an important game late in the year, you'll see them, their eyes lighting up, and they will exclaim with happily if something good happens out there. Although they try to hide it, they try to be tougher than that. But this is an evolving game. Sort of being a fan is a great pleasure. It's a great privilege to be a fan. And since I can write in this personal fashion, I think sometimes I'm trying to speak for the fans. I can't speak for all the fans, but they're the unheard and very important voice in this whole complex business.
You know, another difference between your writing and the writing of sports writers who work for a sports magazine or for a newspaper is that they have to, after the game most of the time, just go back and bang out an article, whereas you have weeks, if not months, to mull over what you've been observing.
Well, I'm not sure it's an advantage. There are times when a few weeks have gone by and I've got several notebooks full of notes and I wish my pieces were over. But, I think that my pieces show a different pace, a different sense of the game. Strangely enough, I often can go back and go into detail about what happened in an important game. A lot of that is being left out of daily writing now because of television. People, the feeling is that
everybody's seen it.
Yeah, they've seen it. They know about how the runs were scored. And I can go back and show how the runs were scored. And that's one of the great things about baseball. It is linear. One thing happens, then another thing happens. And you can keep score. You can take notes. You can think about what happened. And you can recreate it. You can recreate it on paper. Or if you're a fan, you can recreate it in your mind. It's wonderful. Games stay with you for years. You can lie in bed and replay a couple of innings of a game that you saw last year. And you can't do that with other sports.
You know, another special thing about your writing is the way you pull back from the individual game and you muse about the season and about the sport and about the people who play it. I think this is a good time to ask you to read something from your new book. We have a section that we've already chosen. Can you read a passage for us?
Sure, Sherry.
And this is from Roger Angel's new collection of articles titled Season Ticket.
Baseball is not life itself, although the resemblance keeps coming up. It's probably a good idea to keep the two sorted out, but old fans, if they're anything like me, can't help noticing how cunningly our game replicates the larger schedule, with its beguiling April optimism, the cheerful roughhouse of June, the grinding, serious, unending, surely unending business of midsummer, the September settling of accounts when hopes must be traded in for philosophies or brave smiles, and then the abrupt running down of autumn, when we wish for, almost demand, a prolonged and glittering final adventure just before the curtain. But nowhere is this metaphor more insistent than in baseball's sense of slippage, our rueful, fleeting awareness that we tend to pay attention to the wrong things, to last night's rally or tomorrow's pitching matchup, while lesser and sweeter moments slide by unperceived. Players notice this too. Bob Gibson, the most competitive man I've ever seen in the ball field, once told me that what he missed most after he had retired wasn't the competition at all. I don't miss the pitching, but I can't say I don't miss the game, the Cardinal Hall of Famer said. I miss it a little. There's a lot I don't want to get back to. I think it's the life I miss, all the activity that's around baseball. I don't miss playing baseball, but I miss baseball. Baseball. Does that sound like a crazy man?
I like that, and I think you probably really related to that quote about missing the life, not so much the playing of the game, but the life. And I bet you have a life like that as a sports writer, that you have a baseball life during the season.
Yeah, a lot happens, and I have a lot of baseball friends, and I've reached the age now where things come up that suddenly thrill me. I was in spring training this year, and in Port St. Lucie, the new Mets the training center, and I suddenly noticed the Dodgers were there, and I suddenly noticed that the man pitching batting practice was Sandy Koufax, who retired in the 60s, still maybe the best pitcher, certainly the best left-hander I ever saw. And I couldn't get over it. My scalp prickled, and I looked around, and there were a few other people, slightly older baseball people. Bart Giamatti, the president of the National League, was there, and Tim McCarver, who was now Mets broadcaster, Joe Durso of the Times, and we looked at each other, and we all felt the same thing. That's Sandy Koufax out there, and the same motion, seeing that the way he bows his back, and then that over the top delivery was terrifically exciting. Ed Vargo, who was the chief of umpires for the National League, was there, and his eyes lit up, and he told us that he had, as it happened, had been behind the plate for two of Koufax's no-hit games, including the perfect game he once threw. And he described the last batter of that perfect game coming up, who was Harvey Keene. And that's Harvey Keene, who recently died, is a batter I can still see in my mind's eye. I see how he ran down to first with his helmet bobbing because he ran so hard. That Harvey Keene came up with two out of the ninth. Nobody had been on first base. And he turned to Vargo, and he said, the umpire, and he said, "Ed, anything close, call it right away. Get me out of here. Don't embarrass me."
We're going to take
and
a little.
He struck out.
Oh, really? We're going to take a little break here before we talk some more. My guest is Roger Angel, who writes about baseball for The New Yorker magazine. He's also the fiction editor there. His new collection of baseball pieces is called Season Ticket. This is Fresh Air. Roger Angel is my guest, who writes about baseball for The New Yorker magazine and is the author of the new anthology, Season Ticket. Well, you just read us that really nice passage a couple of minutes ago. And, I mean, your baseball writing is really pretty different from the daily baseball journalism, much more elegiac in a way? Is that
well,
the right word?
I think it's sometimes elegiac. I hope it isn't always elegiac. Sometimes called an essayist of baseball, but I think of these pieces as reporting, basically.
Yeah.
And the main difference may be that I'm reporting a little bit later, so there isn't quite as much urgency to and the sort of artificial excitement that is pumped in unconsciously by everybody who's doing baseball or doing sports on the moment. But I think that since this is about me, it is probably more personal as well as about me as a fan.
Uh-huh.
And one of the great rewards of my work is that I hear from other fans around the country, and they write me about their experiences. And some of them have become almost stringers of mine. People write me and said, "What you don't know, you don't know what's right. happening out here with the Padres because you're too far away, or this great thing happened yesterday." So I'm kept up to date in a very personal way. Belonging to baseball is the way I think of it, is what fans do. And it's very much like a family. There's a family feeling with all these old ancestors and heroes that we all share.
You know, you keep talking about writing about baseball from a fan's perspective. And I'm reminded of a book that Christopher Lehman helped, who's the book critic for the New York Times. He spent a season, I think, traveling around following baseball and writing about it for a book. And he, as I recall from the book, felt really kind of in awe of actually meeting all these fans, all these players he had admired for so long. And he was initially very self-conscious about asking them questions, and was especially self-conscious when he was in the locker room with them. And here were his heroes, you know, half-clothed, and he was asking them questions. Did you go through something like that when you started writing?
Sure. When I started, Jerry, I certainly felt that way. And I basically sat in the stands for 2 or 3 years.
Before you got up the courage?
I didn't know as much as the other writers. I didn't want to take up the players' time with dumb questions. I've learned a little bit more now, and the players, they don't care who asks them a question. They barely notice in many cases. But I think at times I've learned to ask the right question, and I think that these players are really dying to talk about the game, particularly if you can get close enough to what they're thinking about it, how difficult it is, the enormous demands of batting. I mean, there's a chapter in here that starts off with a description of Carl Yastrzemski's last day, basically his last couple of days in the major leagues. He played more games than anybody in the American League history. And someone near the end, the game was always very difficult for Yastrzemski. He demanded so much of himself, more than other people almost. And someone that last week found a little note that he taped up inside his locker, which said, "All weight on back foot, head forward," whatever. He was describing to himself the proper batting stance right to the end. He was trying to learn this game, which just that just stuns me. It's amazing. And that for players like that, it isn't always much fun. I always felt that for Yaz, he had a sort of a funereal look because the game had taken so much out of him. And just near the end, the last week or so, he began to brighten up because he knew that this pressure he'd put on himself for 20-odd years in the major leagues was about to be relieved.
You know, I have to ask you a couple of things about working at the New Yorker magazine. I recently read here at the New Yorker Brendan Gill's book about life at the New Yorker. And Gill described you as having an athletic prowess that distinguished you from your colleagues and said that you kept them in awe with your ability to jump onto a tabletop from a standing position. And I was wondering...
I haven't tried it in about 10 years. I'm not sure I could still do it.
I was wondering how you mastered that in the first place. It's not something many of us know how to do.
I think I was trying to fill an empty afternoon or something. or I'm tired of rejecting or whatever I was doing. But
do you think of yourself as athletic?
No, I mean, I'm fairly trim, but I'm 67 years old, and I'm not about to go out and play five sets of singles, but yeah, I'm okay.
I guess the other thing I wanted to know is that I know your mother was Catherine White, who was an editor at The New Yorker, and your stepfather was E.B. White, who wrote for The New Yorker. And I wonder if you were intimidated when you started working there because people who were connected to you in a family way had been so important to the magazine.
Well, I wasn't because I didn't actually go to work as an editor at The New Yorker until I was in my 40s. I'd been working for 15 years on other magazines, and I'd been a contributor for years. I'd written a lot of fiction and humor and different things, so I felt that I had earned my license there. I didn't have to, there was no fear. Nobody felt that I was coming there under false pretenses. And by the time I arrived at the office, my mother had retired, and they were living in Maine. My stepfather was certainly an influence on my writing. I hope.
How so?
Well, I could see watching him, and I could remember him. He used to write notes and comment every week, and I can remember him working from Maine and working all day and half the next day with the door closed and coming out at lunchtime and shaking his head miserably and saying it isn't going well and he'll never get this done, and then putting it in the mail and sometimes trying to get the mail back because it wasn't any good. But what came out, of course, was so effortless and light and beautiful, such a simple and direct and that wonderful glass-like clarity of his writing. And in a way, I think that's a model for all writers. You want to be clear. You want to make it seem effortless. And, of course, it never is effortless. Writing is very difficult. It's difficult for me, and it's difficult for everybody, I think.
So that experience taught you not to be scared at how difficult writing is.
It helped a little.
right. Yeah. I guess you never really get over that that fear. Well, that reminds me, you know, the opening quote in your book is a quote from Ted Williams, and the quote is, "Don't you know how hard this all is?" And the quote refers to batting in particular and baseball in general. But I figured that quote had resonance to you, maybe even about writing.
Well, but it does. But I hope the difficulty of writing doesn't show in the writing. But I don't think it does. But the great thing about baseball is that it really is hard. These people, I mean, I'm in awe of people who sustain a long career in baseball because it is grindingly difficult. And, of course, those stats are kept in. The slightest letdown, and everybody in the world knows it. You just can't dominate the game. At this moment, the Baltimore Orioles have lost 19 games in a row. All those men are professionals. They are deeply embarrassed. Pride is what motivates professional athletes. And you would think, I think fans tend to think, well, if they only try harder, if only this, if only that. But it doesn't work that way, particularly in baseball. You can't turn it the way you want it to, which is it's hard to be a fan when your team starts to lose. It's hard to be a player every day, and sometimes you just have to wait until the end of the string runs out, and somehow you win a game. You end a streak. Things get better.
Why is baseball always considered the writer's sport? I mean, you're a good person to ask this since you've written about it so well for so long.
Well, I think it's the manner we touched on earlier, Sherry. It's linear. Baseball is there are a lot of ways it's not like other sports. There's no clock. The ball is not involved in the scoring. It moves at a different pace. One thing happens, then another thing happens, and then something else happens after that. And you can think about it, and you can go back and look at your scorecard, or you can look at what's happening to the pitcher out there, or how the batters are trying to attack the pitcher. And you can see things beginning to happen. This is very much like writing a book or like reading a book. It's even occurred to me that baseball and reading are not dissimilar because both occupations are for people who aren't afraid of being bored. Sometimes baseball is boring. It's part of its pleasure almost that you're there, nothing much is happening, and you can think about other things. But you need those early chapters, those early innings, if you're going to have a riveting conclusion at the end. If something very complicated and releasing and exciting is going to happen in the latter chapters.
No, it's interesting that you've written some fiction. You're a fiction editor at The New Yorker, but it's really the baseball writing that you've become best known for.
Well, I sure didn't plan it that way. I mean, I didn't have any particular... I certainly never planned to be writing about this for 25 years, but I feel very fortunate. I mean, it's given me a whole different life. I have an office life, an editor's life, and a writer's life. It has given me a whole group of friends and associations. It's given me a little attention, whatever. And it's allowed me to write about myself, which is what all writers want to do deep down. It's been very lucky, and I hope it goes on. I plan to keep on with this as long as I can.
Gene, it gets you out of the office and into the sun while you're still writing.
Yeah, that's right.
not a bad thing. I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing and about baseball.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
My guest has been Roger Angel, and he writes about baseball for The New Yorker magazine. This week his annual spring training piece is in. A collection of his pieces has just been published. It's titled Season Ticket, A Baseball Companion, and it's just been published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.